Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. After 4 months of protests, the 30-year ruler of Sudan has been ousted. The oppressive President Omar al-Bashir was arrested and deposed by the military. Protesters have paid a heavy price for taking to the streets. Human Rights Watch says 51 people have been killed, 180 have been injured, and thousands have been arrested. Protesters fear another reign of oppression. They say they reject the military takeover and vow to stay on the streets until their demands are met. It is estimated that up to two-thirds of the protesters are women, according to the BBC. Wafag Keshirashi told the BBC that, quote, there is no amount of beating or detention that could make us stop, end quote. Joining us to discuss the latest is Hana Baba, a reporter and co-host of Cross Currents, a daily radio news magazine that broadcasts here on KALW in San Francisco. Hana has reported on how Sudan's uprising is inspiring a generation of Sudanese American teens. She reported on that for PRI and for KALW. In February, Hana returned from Khartoum, the capital city of Sudan, where she spent 3 weeks visiting family and talking to people on the streets. Hi, Hana. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Hana. You have been following everything that's unfolding very closely on Twitter. You also have family and friends in Sudan. Give us a sense of the latest. What has been happening in the past 24 hours?
Right. Well, just to go back to Thursday night when news broke of the possibility that President Omar al-Bashir is going to step down. And so, you know, social media was buzzing, the internet was buzzing, our WhatsApp were lighting up with this news that it's happening, what's happening, what's happening. So, as you said, for the past 4 months, there people have been protesting, but for the past week, there's been a huge sit-in outside the country's main army headquarters. Hundreds of thousands of people for the past week were just camping out outside the army headquarters. They brought their tents. People donated mattresses. People were donating food and drinks and water, and they were not going away. And this is men and women. And the army in overall was kind of sitting on the sidelines and just letting people kind of have that moment and that space. And eventually the army started to protect these people from the police forces that were called in by Omar al-Bashir's government, and they started clashing among themselves. All of this with these hundreds of thousands of protesters still in the space. And some people have compared it to Tahrir Square in Egypt. I don't like to make comparisons with other countries or other people's, you know, experiences, because everyone's experience is unique. But it is reminiscent of that, right? You have these people who are just living there, and tons of donations coming in. People are organizing online and through social media. Who's going to bring the water today? Who's going to, you know, some guy made these chargers out of nothing, just brought some tools from home and started saying, okay, people, you can charge your phones here. There's like a theatrical troupe over here, musicians over here. It's really something to see. I urge people to go online and look for these images and these videos, because they're very cool. And so this has been happening. Thursday night, Sudan TV and Sudan Radio start to broadcast military music only, right? So they cut off all broadcasts. For Sudanese people, I think for a lot of people in our areas of the world, they know what this means. Something is going to happen. Something is going on. Somebody has taken over TV and radio, which is the first thing the military usually does when a coup happens, right? And so we're all tuned in, and there's this military music continuing, and then an announcer would come up and say, your armed forces are going to make an announcement soon, right? And we're here. We've just gotten back from work. My daughter's back from school. Everybody's tuned in all over the country, all over, you know, Sudanese diaspora, biting our nails, just sitting there watching Sudan TV, with this military music. And it went on for hours, and we stayed up. And it went on for 4 or 5 hours. And so people started celebrating in those camps in Khartoum. We started seeing people just like chanting and yelling and flags everywhere, and women, you know, just dancing around, and people started celebrating that, okay, this is happening. So what happened was, a man named Awad ibn Auf, who was the vice president of al-Bashir, and who was the vice president of al-Bashir, came forward. He was on TV, on the radio, saying, Omar al-Bashir is gone. He's been deposed. And essentially making a statement. So that statement included the fact that there will be a military council put in place to oversee this country for 2 years. After the 2 years, there will be elections. Within 2 minutes of this statement, people started protesting again. Mm. Because the idea is that this is not what people were thinking about, right? The idea is that, yes, we want Omar al-Bashir to go, but with his whole regime. It's not about a person. It's about a regime as a whole. So when you come to me and you are the vice president, right, and the minister of defense, and telling me, well, this person, you know, the president has gone, but everybody else on your new military council, it's kind of the same old, same old, same old faces. So then it was very heartbreaking, you know, to go online and see people go from cheers and laughter to sadness and crying, right? Yeah. And those images, you know, it's just like within minutes this happened. Political prisoners were all free, so that's a big positive, right? The number one positive was Omar al-Bashir is gone. Number two is all political prisoners were freed, which is a big deal, including all the women. I know you want to talk about women, the women in the protests, the women political leaders of Sudan. They were all jailed and arrested, beaten, and so they were. All of them were released. What did they do? They went home. They took a shower. They came back to the protest.
Well, and we'll talk about that in a minute, Hana. But the military, so the military arrested al-Bashir and 100 of his men. And were people surprised to learn that the military then took over?
People were surprised because, I mean, the idea that the military was going to take over again, right? I think some people expected it, because that's historically what happens. The military takes control and says, okay, we're here, we're going to hold this together for a month, right? Until everybody, all, you know, civic society organizations and parties come forward and we agree on something. But this idea of 2 years is what had people really wondering, well, wait a minute, what is this really? And is this just political theater? And the cartoons also started to come out, and the artists started to make art where you would see, like, Omar al-Bashir, a cartoon of Bashir, gone, but other people who look like him, like little minions, are, like, in government. Or things like, you know, like, he would be flying away into the air somewhere, but he's really kind of hiding behind the scenes. He's like the director of the theater, of this play. So people are not trusting. And you can imagine why people are not trusting. This is 30 years of this dictatorship. And one particular reason people have not trusted this is because 30 years ago, when this government came to power, there was a man named Hassan al-Turabi. He was a spiritual leader, Muslim Brotherhood leader, who kind of schemed with the army to help them come into power. And the idea was, the play, the trick, the theater was, I will go into prison, you can jail me, and you will go into the palace. So that's even a little a thing that people are remembering right now. I will go to prison and you will go to the palace. So that was a plan. And so people are remembering that right now, right? Like, Ramon al-Bashir is somewhere. Nobody knows where he is. The council is saying we will not hand him over to the ICC, the International Criminal Court, where he is wanted for crimes against humanity for his role in Darfur. He's saying, oh, they're saying we will try him in Sudan. It's all just fishy. And it's all just, it feels like a big dupe, and people feel duped, and they're not having it. They're back protesting again and demanding a civilian council be formed, not a military one.
Today we are talking about what is happening on the ground in Sudan with Hannah Baba, a reporter and co-host of Cross Currents, a daily radio news magazine that broadcasts here on KALW in San Francisco. She has reported on how Sudan's uprising has inspired a generation of Sudanese Americans. And Hannah was last in Sudan in February, and she's going to be with us for just over 10 more minutes. So if you have any questions for Hannah about what is happening in Sudan, it's finally, for obvious reasons, getting a lot of media attention, but that was not the case just about a month and a half ago. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Hannah, when we had you on the show on March 1st, we were talking about demonstrations happening in more than 50 areas across Sudan. The country had never seen anything like this before. So can you remind listeners why so many people took to the streets and really put their lives at risk? Because according to Human Rights Watch, 51 people have been killed.
Right. There's been a lot of killing. There's been thousands of arrests, again, men and women. This originally was sparked. So the people in Sudan have been under this regime for 30 years. There's people who, you know, they were born in this time, and that's the only regime they know. But there's a lot of people who remember what it was before, and so there's a lot of mistrust already. There's already corruption, heavy amount, you know. Corruption is just rampant. But what really sparked it, I think, and it was just like a reason, but one reason, was inflation and bread prices going up, and bread shortages and fuel shortages as well. So for many years, it's the corruption, it's the oppression, it's the, you know, the just like lack of opportunity. People have been leaving the country. It's just been like hemorrhaging people since 30 years. People, if you have a way to leave Sudan, you will, because of the state of the country. But what really did it, I think, was when people felt it in their daily lives. Right? There was no gas. There's no bread. Prices started climbing because of Sudan's debt internationally, and it just wasn't. I think people lost their patience at that point. Sudanese people, if you know them, are very patient people. And so at that point, demonstrations started first, actually not even in Khartoum, the capital. It started in Natbara, in the north of Sudan. And then slowly they started spreading around the country. And they reached Khartoum late, actually. And so that kind of what brought this up, but people have been suffering for decades. This is just the reason that these protests began.
And what is happening in these other cities?
Exactly. My one of my journalist friends was writing earlier today saying, wait a minute, everybody's focused on Khartoum, the capital, because this is where this is all happening, but we need to really think about what's happening outside of Khartoum also. And you know, give marginalized voices also the chance to you know, be listed in media. So they've been posting videos from places like Port Sudan, which is the eastern port of the country. They've been posting from places in the north, even in the very west, in the Darfur, region. Today there was an awesome video from a city called Zalingé. And so, again, hundreds of protesters just like in a market, right? And it's uplifting, right? It's saying that this is not just the kind of the elite people who are able to come to the capital city and live in the capital city who are leading these protests. Everybody wants this regime gone.
When we had you on in March, Hannah, we were talking about just the lack of media coverage. I think we cited NPR and the New York Times and said, I think we read about two stories. Mm-hmm. And yet so much was happening. I mean, again, the country had never seen anything like this. Obviously, it's now getting front page coverage. I mean, today's New York Times, the story is, it's kind of a strange headline, but it's Sudan's spider cast from web after 30 years. Military oust leader of purge in Darfur. So what do you think? Now that Sudan is on the front page headlines, it's leading the BBC, PBS NewsHour, NPR, what do you think of the coverage now?
They're late to the game. Thank you, Rose, for being on it when it was actually, you know, starting to happen. Since yesterday, the day before yesterday, my telephone's been buzzing, just people calling, you know, like you said, PBS NewsHour, BBC, Deutsche Welle, CNN, all of these places, you know, asking for people, you know, who do you know on the ground in Sudan? And that's another thing. They're asking us to connect them to people on the ground, which is a good thing. Right? Because me sitting here in my San Francisco Bay Area, do I have really the right to talk about what's on the ground over there? So we're giving them leads, we're giving them information, and just, you know, not criticizing, but just being grateful at this point, just to let this coverage happen. But it's real that, like, I wonder, we were talking about this with my friends, what is it that finally brought the media, the international media? Because it was... There was no coverage.
Right.
So what was sexy enough? What was that glimmery, shimmery thing that finally made international media pay attention? And I think it was the viral image of Alaa Salah. She is a woman that was part of the protest, and she was wearing a white thobe, which is like a sari, like an Indian sari, that it's called a thobe. It's our traditional dress. And she got on top of a car at this moment, and she was starting to chant and say, you know, chant poetry to rile, you know, to rally people. And there was this moment where she was kind of holding her hand up, you know, in poetry, and people were around her, and it was this moment. I guess it was like 4 o'clock, because it was like that good 4 o'clock light where you take photos, and it's really like at that afternoon light. And somebody took the photo. Her name was Lena Haroun. I have to say these names because they deserve to be said. Somebody took that picture. It went viral, and it became this iconic image of look what's happening in Sudan. Look at the women of Sudan leading protests. And so that image went viral. I mean, Lena Haroun's Twitter went from like 200 followers to and Alaa Salah too. I checked just before we talked, it's like 30,000 followers, you know. So I think we're in the age of an image and clicks, and going viral will get you in media more than what's actually happening on the ground, which has been going on for a while now, right? But why this moment? I'm going to take it, and again, just, you know, I'm an optimistic person, so I'm going to take it and say it was a good thing. But honestly, there's a lot of mixed feelings right now about the idea that this one photo just brought all the media on, and you know, it's a lot of kind of mixed feelings about it, I think, especially among Sudanese women. But hey, you know, it is what it is. But there's got to be. I mean, I'm talking about commercial media. I'm talking about the international media. There's got to be better ways for them to get in earlier and to care earlier, and just to be on it. Mm.
And Hana, just to stick with this image for a moment, Lena Haroon, so she's only 22 years old. And as you said, on one hand, it's great. Thank you.
Ala is the woman in the picture.
Yeah. Okay.
Lena is the one who took the picture.
Oh, okay. Thank you. As you said, it's whatever it takes to get the coverage on one hand, right? Because there was hardly any coverage last month. But at the same time, it also just it shows how, you know, the Middle East, I mean, Africa, how women are stereotyped by the West. And just it also shows how much people really don't know what happens in countries. I mean, there's just a lot of, generalizations, for example.
There's generalizations. I think part of the frustration with this was, again, the world kind of being shocked and amazed by these women who are daring to go out into the street when, we thought they were, at home with men holding, just like swords to their necks. Or whatever images they have in their heads, right? There's images, there's stereotypes of women, Muslim women, women in Africa, women in the Middle East, that, that we are all these oppressed, burqa-wearing women, whereas if you just do a simple Google search, women in Sudan, history of political involvement of women in Sudan, go online and look at pictures, see what, I wonder what women in Sudan have been doing.
Mm.
That curiosity, rather than just feeding into stereotypes, women in Sudan have been at the forefront of politics since independence, right? Before independence, since the 30s and the 40s. We've had some of the first in the Arab region and the African region in terms of the first parliamentarians, the first judges, and so it's offensive. Like, when I'm reading some of these headlines and I'm seeing some of this coverage, you're just coming to this party late. You're just learning for the first time that the women of Sudan are powerful and outspoken and supportive of their political change. And it's just like it's late and it's not enough. Again, I'm glad people are on it right now, but hopefully somebody's learning a lesson, and a lot of my friends are writing about this. We're writing an article as well about this kind of these stereotypes in people's minds and how this revolution has changed those, but at the same time, how offensive it feels to us who have always known the truth.
Right. And since you say it's important to name names, the Globe Post had a great piece, and they quoted Nemat Malik, an 80-year-old nurse and university professor in Khartoum, who said she was pleased to see so many women on the streets. She said, quote, "This regime is a lot of harassment and oppression for women, especially women have suffered a lot." They also quoted Isan Fagiri, a 65-year-old doctor who teaches in Khartoum, and she was detained for 2.5 months by Sudanese security forces to keep her away from the protests. So I thought this piece was great because it actually quoted women. And Hana, we have just a couple minutes left, just briefly. I've noticed that today's New York Times piece is about Sudan. The reporters are not writing from Sudan. Are there many international correspondents in Sudan or the surrounding areas?
Sure. So in Sudan, no. Journalists have been jailed, sought out, and jailed in Sudan. So it's a place where not a lot of international journalism has been happening. Even Sudanese journalists who work for international channels have been harassed and arrested and jailed. And so it's what's happening right now is I'm seeing people, international media, saying, what can we do to report this, right? That's kind of one of the responses. And one of the responses to that is have people on the ground just use their whatever they have, right? iPhone voice memo works great, videos, whatever material can come out of there. But international media is really lacking in there. And that's a problem.
Right.
That is a problem. Right.
Well, Hana, we would love to do an hour show about Sudan, and we'd love to have you back. Thank you so much for all of your reporting, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Rose.
Hana Baba is a reporter and co-host of Cross Currents, a daily radio news magazine that broadcasts here on KALW. She's also co-host of the Stoop podcast, and you can find her pieces on how Sudan's uprising is inspiring a generation of Sudanese Americans at yourcallradio.org. Coming up after the break, we will speak with New York Times reporter John Schwartz about the devastating floods here in the United States and around the globe. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. We'll be back after this. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. Over the past few months, we have seen devastating floods in places like the Midwest, the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota, and the Missouri River. In Iran, 70 people have been killed after record rainfalls, and just yesterday, 70,000 people have been ordered to flee their homes. And the following numbers are from ReliefWeb. In Mozambique, the death toll stands at 602 because of flooding. In Zimbabwe, 299 people are dead, more than 186 injured. 270,000 people have been affected. In Malawi, 59 people are dead, 672 injured, and 87,000 displaced in emergency centers. In a recent piece, today's guest, New York Times reporter John Schwartz, asks, what makes a catastrophic flood, and is climate change causing more of them? Short answer, yes. Longer answer, it's still complicated. John Schwartz is a climate change writer for the New York Times, where he has worked since 2000, covering science, technology, infrastructure, space, legal affairs, and more. Hi, John. Welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. The damages to the homes and the farms in the Midwest are expected to total at least $3 billion. The cyclone that destroyed 90% of Beira in Mozambique, it's the country's fourth largest city, home to 1.5 million people. I mean, John, just looking at these floods in the last couple weeks, last couple months, I hope I have most of them, but it was hard to keep track. There's just so much happening.
Well, and it's a big planet. And over time, we're just seeing these tremendous weather events. Last year's hurricanes, and in Puerto Rico, Maria, Panama, in Florida, in the Panhandle of Florida, between hurricanes and coastal flooding and the interior flooding from increased rainfall that is tied to climate change is something you'd expect to see under climate change conditions. Flooding is an enormous problem, and of course, water is very destructive. It finds its level. It doesn't care that you live there, and so it's an amazing problem that we're dealing with in places. In places around the country and around the world.
I mean, the videos coming out of Iran and Mozambique, I mean, the videos everywhere, the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota, they're just devastating. I mentioned the piece that you wrote recently, John, What Makes a Catastrophic Flood and Is Climate Change Causing Most of Them? You spoke with Diki Arndt, a climate scientist at NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. And Deke said, flooding is complex. And you write, so does climate change play a role? Short answer, yes. Longer answer, it's still complicated. So what are you hearing from scientists?
Well, the first thing they want you to understand is that a flood is a very complicated set of events that come together to raise water in an area. And lots of things contribute to that. Bad luck is a big part of it, rainfall. The terrain is a big, big part of it. You know, you're going to get these tremendous gully washers in a place like Vermont because it's steep hills and valleys. And so the water can be forced into narrow areas. And when you get a super heavy rainfall, you're going to get roads washed out. You're going to get bridges washed out. Development reduces the amount of absorbent ground. And so you get a lot more water sort of rolling around in areas that are heavily developed. But even more than that, in these last ones that we were writing about, then the upper Midwest and the plains, a lot of that had very much to do with a big hunk of late snowfall that put a lot of liquid, put a lot of snow on the ground, which then starts to melt and spreads a lot of water around, and then super heavy rains that that send that water everywhere. And so, and it's hitting on ground, flat earth, that itself is frozen. And so because the ground is still cold, the ground is frozen, and so the water has nowhere to go. It's not going to be absorbed into that ground. Those factors together are a huge part of that particular flood. But on top of that, you have the conditions of climate change, which one of the smart climate scientists I talked to said it's like taking it's like when an athlete takes steroids. That athlete was going to hit a certain number of home runs, but there might be more home runs, and certainly the ball will be hit farther. That what's happening is the climate system is getting juiced with the effects of climate change. These places had floods plenty of times before. There were always hurricanes, typhoons before. What we see now is that, for instance, with a storm like Harvey sitting over Houston and sending 50 inches of rain into parts of Houston and Beaumont, that you have a warming atmosphere, which causes not just a warming atmosphere that holds more moisture, and so that moisture gets squeezed out of the atmosphere in the form of rain, and you get more rain. So you have these, you might not have more storms necessarily, but a heavy downpour is going to be heavier. You're going to see this, and so the conditions for a quick flood are greater. And that heavy rainfall, that inundating, frog-strangling rainfall, is what we're seeing more of, and which is consistent with what climate change projections say, and which is expected to get worse.
I want to ask you about an opinion piece written by two mayors, Jacob Frey, mayor of Minneapolis, and Frank Klippisch, mayor of Davenport, Iowa. They wrote a piece in USA Today called "As Floods Deluge Midwest Towns, Where is National Response to Climate Disasters?" They write, "Americans are now seeing the nightmare unfold that mayors throughout the Midwest have warned about for years. Breached levees, flooded farms, washed out roads, drowned homes are disrupting lives, devastating communities, and straining state and city budgets. But the floods that made headlines and caught the attention of presidential campaigners are not the first and will not be the last." So what about this? I mean, given the devastation that we are seeing, where is the national response to this?
Well, national response is pretty lacking, except that we have the Corps of Engineers out on doing its flood fight missions in a lot of these flooded areas, pretty much as they always do. They're there to help coordinate adding sandbags to levees and getting information out about where they see the flooding. But that's not doing what we need to do, which is to have a better flood strategy around the country and really apply the lessons of what we know about these rainfall events and try to mitigate, adapt, and deal with the effects. And in the same way that we're seeing the wildfire season in the West and then the Southeast starting earlier, lasting longer, where the drying effects of the aridification of the West are giving us a big problem in wildfires, but all the government, all the federal response is to continue to fight them, as opposed to trying to come up with ways to do a better job of controlled burns where that could be helpful, to do the proper kind of thinning and maintenance that helps prevent these fires from getting out of hand, and really working with communities to make sure that people aren't building where they're going to be at the greatest risk. Same with flooding. We need to do a better job through FEMA and the other housing and flood agencies to make sure that people have flood insurance, but also have flood protection, aren't building in the path of the waters, and that our way of estimating where places are going to be at risk has to become better, more precise, and more forward-looking. We can't base our flood protection decisions on past events, because the past is turning out to be a pretty poor guide to what we're seeing. It used to be the past was a terrific guide to what we would, to where we shouldn't be building and what we should know about flood risk. But the world is changing, and our tools have to become better. And the federal government needs to step up and do a lot of that. There's effort being made to get there, but we could be a lot farther along than we are.
And the damage is staggering. According to USA Today, Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds says the flooding has cost her state $1.6 billion and submerged at least 1,200 homes. Roughly 70 miles of levees operated by the Army Corps of Engineers are damaged or destroyed. The cost of repair is estimated at $350 million. An additional 175 miles of levees that are not federally owned need repairs, and that would cost an additional $175 million. This is just a small example of the damage that is done. What else really strikes you, John, about just the let's just talk about the financial cost, and then we'll talk about the human cost.
Well, in terms of the cost, you know, $1 spent in trying to protect against this kind of damage has a sixfold effect. If you can put the money into protecting communities, it's so much cheaper and so much better than just coming in after some place has been destroyed and helping with cleanup and doing repairs. And that kind of forward-looking approach to flood protection is more of what we need. I was in New Orleans for the New York Times after Katrina hit in 2005, and it made an impression on me. I came from a town, Galveston, Texas, that was wiped out by a hurricane in 1900. And one of my earliest memories is of my family moving into a local hotel, a multi-story hotel, for Hurricane Carla in 1961. You don't need to tell me that water is dangerous. I've seen it all my life. Mm-hmm. But we need to make sure that everybody who hadn't had the upbringing I had knows that as well.
Today we're speaking with John Schwartz, climate change writer for the New York Times, and we're talking about the devastating floods that we're seeing around the world. If you have any questions or comments about the coverage, it definitely is getting coverage. Sometimes you have to look for it. There have been pieces about what's going on in Mozambique, Malawi. John's colleague, Mitch Smith, wrote a very important piece called A State of Emergency, Native Americans Stranded for Days by Flooding. On the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation in South Dakota, extreme weather and bad roads have left some residents stranded for nearly 2 weeks with limited food and water. You can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Mitch Smith brings up another important point here, John, and that is when we have a crumbling infrastructure, and usually the United States gets a report card of a D because the infrastructure needs so many repairs, oh, it just gets worse after flooding, right?
Well, that's right. And recovering from the damage means you're not building to, if all you're ever doing is repairing, then you don't get around to the upgrading. Of course, upgrading from repairing from damage is far more expensive than doing it right the first time. So these levees, you know, our dams are on average 50 years old, I believe, if I'm remembering that right. This country really dropped the ball on providing the kind of infrastructure that we need to be safe, and that's one level of failure. Yeah, the responsibility goes down to states that can be doing more, county and local level that can be helping organize people for disaster, and then individuals have a responsibility too. You know, as individuals living in areas that can flood, you should know where you're going to evacuate. You should know how you're going to evacuate. You should have stuff ready to, you know, take upstairs to a high room if it looks like a flood is coming. These are ways that you can prepare for disaster and minimize the effects so that maybe you'll have to rip out your carpet, but you won't lose all the family photos. You won't lose all your important financial documents, your family personal documents. If you have a sort of procedure in place to get out of town or get upstairs and take your medications with you, so it's not a health issue, just that little bit of preparation is enough to really make a difference for a lot of people. Knowing the risk you're under and being ready to act on it is a huge part of disaster preparedness that isn't about how good your levees are, because no levee is perfect. And these heavier rains are coming.
I talked about the Pine Ridge Reservation, and huge thanks to your colleague Mitch Smith for writing about this.
Oh, isn't he wonderful? Isn't he fantastic?
Well, and he actually went to Pine Ridge to do this story, and I noticed that up until then, it didn't really get that much attention from the national media. NPR had a piece last month, March 25th, but I'm looking online right now. There doesn't seem to be that many stories other than, I will say, local media. Oklahoma's News Channel, The Olympian, has a piece just in the last couple of days. And this has really been devastating. You've got 40,000 members of the Oglala Lakota live on the Pine Ridge Reservation. This is roughly the size of Delaware and Rhode Island combined. I mean, so many people live in poverty. About half live in poverty. The unemployment rate hovers at 90%. Many people live in deteriorating houses and cramped mobile homes. Members of the tribe were actually tweeting and saying, we cannot get access to food and water. And there's now, fundraisers to help people there. The flooding has made the roads impassable, and people have been trapped for over 2 weeks. What about this, John, when people are so isolated and they can't get access to basic goods?
It's horrifying, and the word needs to get out. I mean, one of the problems that you're pointing to is that there's very little national media left that has the resources to deploy people to these places when disaster strikes. And the crisis in local news around the country is that a lot of those sources have been cut back so much that they can't provide really terrific coverage either. Mm-hmm. Even when disaster strikes, which would be the kind of story that every local place would every local publication would cover, that the lights are sort of blinking out on local news around the country, and even at the national level, these publications, a lot of them don't have the resources to send people to see these things firsthand. And I'm very grateful if the Times was able to send Mitch to the reservation and around. I mean, he put thousands of miles on the car he was driving around for that series of stories and that bit of flooding. But it's a tough environment for news, and when you don't have the reporters out there, people suffer sort of in the dark.
That's why
the press is important for democracy, right?
Right. Well, and I was going to say, John, since you have been with the New York Times since 2000, 19 years, what changes have you seen, and what really concerns you the most, given that reporting on these issues is so important?
Well, of course, the financial squeeze on journalism, and especially print journalism, has been devastating all over the country. And one of the things I like about the Times is that the editor of the Times, Dean Baquet, looked at this a couple of years ago and said, local news is in crisis around the country. What can we do to help with that? And he came up with a project that I worked on for the better part of a year with Kevin Sack, one of my colleagues, who's just a brilliant investigative journalist with a sort of poet's touch to his writing. And we partnered with the New Orleans Times-Picayune, which has one of the great environmental reporters of the world, Mark Schlefstein, and two other terrific environmental reporters who he is working with there, Tristan Barak and Sarah Sneath. And we spent months in and around New Orleans and a little town south of New Orleans called Jean Lafitte, and talked about coastal land loss, sea level rise, hurricane protection, risk, levees, and did a series of stories called The Vanishing Coast, which we published as a standalone section of the New York Times with terrific photography from just brilliant, beautiful photography, and then a lot of Will Widmer stuff and some Tim Wallace. And then the Times-Picayune side published their own freestanding section, and they called it Our Vanishing Coast. But the stories were the same, but the presentation was different because we're different publications. But that partnership allowed them to take on the kind of project that they have trouble doing these days, mm-hmm. because the funding just isn't there to set three people apart and tell them you're going to work on this for a year. You know, and it drew attention to the science, it drew attention to the human stories. I'm not trying to be an ad for the New York Times here, I'm just saying that the problem, and the Times can't partner with every paper in the country either, but the thing that we did was something I was very proud to be a part of, and those stories stand as a testament to I think how journalism can explain hard things in human terms.
Completely agree, and we actually would love to do a story around the piece "Glaciers Are Retreating, Millions Rely on Their Water." Henry Fountain.
Oh, Henry. Oh, my God, Henry.
Henry Fountain, a New York Times reporter, and Ben Solomon, a Times multimedia reporter, traveled to Kazakhstan to see the effects of climate change on mountain glaciers. And it's kind of this beautiful, I mean, it's alarming to read, but it's so beautiful. The photos, it's interactive. You almost feel like you're there. In Central Asia, a warming climate is shrinking. It's losing ice every year. Around the world, vanishing glaciers will mean less water for people and crops in the future.
Well, Henry's a brilliant colleague, and you know, and these images from Kazakhstan that Ben got were fantastic. And you know, and that story talks about glaciers around the world, but you get this gripping imagery from one place, a place that not many people get to go to. And you know, this is not, I mean, Henry was climbing the glacier. He's my age. We're old guys. But you get out there and you get to do these things in order to convey the experience to people, in order to convey the news. And the visual presentation of that one especially is just so stunning. And there are he did three glacier stories. And that one ran, and then there was a second story from Switzerland about how the Swiss are hoping to take advantage of these next few decades of glacial loss by using it to create electricity. And then a third one that I think is going to come out in the next week that he worked on. So Henry is a terrific colleague, and if you get a chance to talk to him, I highly recommend it. You know, the team of people at the Times that write about climate solely, again, I'm going to do another ad for the Times. I'm sorry. I don't have the jingle ready to play for you. But it's really exciting to be part of a team of people who cover climate full-time. Mm-hmm. Having people like Kendra Pierre-Lewis and Somini Sengupta and Hiroko Tabuchi and Brad Plumer and Lisa Friedman and Coral Davenport, these are all people who have carved out different parts of this globally important story, and we, you know, we write about it all the time. I can't believe I get to do this for a living.
Well, I wanted to mention a comment from a caller who cannot stay on. Karen said, "The crisis is not at the border. It is inside the country. We need to spend money on infrastructure, not the wall." And I mean, the Pine Ridge, everything we're talking about today, every place needs improvements. The Pine Ridge Reservation, Henry just wrote in, Lakota People's Law Project is letting people know how they can contribute, and we'll put information on our website right after the show. But what about that? I mean, there's a crisis in the country in these places we're talking about, John.
There's a crisis in the country, and our national priorities have shortchanged these infrastructure issues for quite some time. This didn't start with this administration. It's just that the contrast seemed greater. But, you know, where were we on doing flood protection 10 years ago, 15 years ago, as some of these issues started to play out? We started, it's not like we discovered climate change in the last 2 years. And so, you know, national priorities need to be focused on the sort of stuff that we can do long term to protect people. The problem is that human beings aren't very good generally at thinking for the long term and spending money now for something with benefits far into the future. We built the highway system in this country. We built the Hoover Dam. We've done big projects in the past. We've fallen out of the frame of mind that allows us to do that. And then we get focused on immediate, you know, things that look like immediate problems, and our politicians aren't showing the kind of leadership that lets us look farther into the future and spend the money where it'll do the most good.
Mm, yeah, it's such a great point, because the infrastructure report card from engineers, it's been a D plus for many, many, many years. So this definitely is not new, and we will do a show about the infrastructure in the coming months. John Schwartz is a climate change writer for The New York Times, and you can find his reporting at yourcallradio.org. John, thank you for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you. It's such a pleasure talking with you.
A pleasure to talk with you. Thank you. Have a nice weekend. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show, and David LaTulipe, our studio engineer. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.